2 Kings chapter 17. We are in the history of Israel. Well, actually, we pretty much finished the history of Israel last week because Israel and Judah split, you remember, after Solomon, his son, the split happened and the 10 tribes in the north went their own way because they didn't like Solomon's son to be king over them. And Jeroboam took over up there. And in the south, you had Judah, which ended up being Judah and Benjamin. They were centered around Jerusalem. And as we've been going through the books of Kings, it's been bouncing back and forth between king in the north, king in the south. This is what happened during the north reign. This is what happened in the south. Back and forth, back and forth. Well, last week, it finally got to the place where Israel in the north, who had turned away from the Lord, had gone as far as they could go. And the Lord allowed Syria to come in and carry them off captive. They were conquered and taken out of the land. And that's kind of where we're picking it up. The first part of chapter 17 was the Lord explaining again why it is that he allowed them to be kicked out of the land, just telling one more time, this is what I commanded them, this is what I promised them, this is what I told them to do, and this is what they did, and this is why I've allowed them to be driven out of the land. Verse 16, we'll pick up right there. It says, and they left all the commandments of the Lord their God, and made them molten images, even two calves, and made a grove, and worshipped all the host of heaven, and served Baal. And they caused their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire, and used divination and enchantments, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel, and removed them out of his sight, and there was none left but the tribe of Judah only. Down in the south, that is what we said. And in fact, what we pick up really in verse 19, it says, also Judah kept not the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the statutes of Israel, which they made. Here they have this wonderful lesson of all of the stuff going on with Israel in the north, and yet they refused to take heed to it. And rather than seeing what had gone on in Israel and realizing the pain they suffered because of it and turning from it, instead, they actually followed after. I mean, we read last week about Ahaz, king of Judah, who himself was causing his sons to be passed through the fire, sacrificing his children to these pagan idols. And they were, instead of being different and learning from the Norse scar tissue, they decided that they walked in the statutes of Israel. Notice what it says, which they made. Because everyone has their own statutes. Everyone has their own law. If you don't know the Lord, if you don't follow his statutes, you certainly will come up with your own. Everybody has their level of what's okay and what isn't. I've yet to ever meet anybody who truly has said anything goes. On some level, you can all agree that there is some standard of bad, whether it's Hitler or, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer. There's always some level of bad, and everyone has their standards. Even in prison, there is standards and levels of what is okay and what isn't. And you know, it's funny, and when you take someone who has been, you know, heinously evil, you take someone who's I remember talking with a friend of mine who spent some time in jail, and, you know, there was a certain class of criminal that would come in that when they found out that a child molester or, someone like that was in the prison, they would execute judgment themselves because they would say, that's way too far and we need to deal with that. I mean, even in the prison, there's a level of commandments, but these guys had come up with their own. Israel apparently didn't like what the Lord had said, and so they made their own statutes and they made their own commandments and they came up with their own traditions. And it's the same thing that we do. In Jesus' day, he dealt with it. The religious leaders, they had his word, and instead they had come up with their own level of holiness based upon keeping their own commandments, and he soundly rebuked them and said, you teach your traditions like they are the word of, in fact, you dismiss the word of God in favor of keeping your traditions. Well, that's what Judah was doing in the south. They were following the statutes that Israel in the north had made. It says in verse 20, and the Lord rejected all the seed of Israel and afflicted them and delivered them into the hand of the spoilers until he cast them out of his sight. For he rent Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, king. And Jeroboam drave Israel from following the Lord and made them sin a great sin. And remember, Jeroboam was the guy who was afraid that all of the Israelites in the north would go follow Judah in the south because that's where the temple was. So he came up with the two golden calves, stuck one in the north in Dan and Bethel in the south, and said, you don't have to go. This is the Lord who brought you out. Remember the golden calf? Well, here it is. This is the Lord who brought you out, and we'll worship the Lord right here. It's very convenient. It's historical. There was a golden calf back with Aaron, so why not? And Jeroboam was the one who started that, and he's long dead now, and yet his name is still brought up with this. For the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did, and they departed not from them, until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said by all his servants the prophets. So was Israel carried away out of their own land to Assyria unto this day, or unto the day of the writing of this book. Now, it doesn't mean that all 10 of the tribes have disappeared forever. You know, every once in a while, some wacko will come in and start teaching about the lost tribes of Israel and how they're, or they'll try to put us into the lost tribes. I've seen people who tried to say that the church, if you're saved, it means that you actually are in some way a physical descendant of one. It's crazy. The truth is, at various times, people who were still serving the Lord would migrate to the south. Multiple places it tells about like the Levites and whatnot that wanted to serve the Lord and they couldn't. They were bugged by the idolatry. They moved down in the south. There were those, we're going to see with Hezekiah, who's coming up next. He's going to call for a Passover, which hadn't been celebrated since, I think, Solomon. And he invited all the north, and most of them laughed him to scorn, but there were a few that came. And there are always some, so it's not like these tribes are gone completely. In fact, when you get into Revelation chapter 7, it tells us that there's going to be 12,000 from the tribe of Naphtali and 12,000 from the tribe of Ephraim, and they're all laid out. And they are literally from that tribe. The Lord hasn't lost anybody. He knows everybody's identity. He knows right where they are. And certainly, the Jews are miraculous in that they're different than every other people group and that they have not lost their national identity. Even though they were carried away for 70 years into Babylon, they remain Jews. They continued to marry within themselves, and they've stayed. They did not mix with the other nations. In fact, gone from the land for almost 2,000 years. Now they're going back again. And still, Israel is Israel. And the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon, in Cutha, and from Ava, and from Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they possessed Samaria, and dwelt in the cities thereof. And so it was at the beginning of their dwelling there that they feared not the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which slew some of them. What Assyria would do when it conquered a nation is it would take the people out of the land that it conquered, a majority of them, and it would bring them to someplace else that it had conquered and dump them there and force them to live there. Then it would take people from a different land and dump them back into that other homeland. And so Israel in the north has been carried away, and they've taken people from these other countries I just read and mispronounced and dropped them into Samaria and the other lands and said, here, you're going to live here now. So there's no national identity. There is no familiarity with the land or national pride anymore. So they would be subject to Assyria. They become amalgamated with Assyria. And so now Samaria in the north is now filled with other peoples that were conquered by Assyria, and the Israelites are gone. However, it says when they started there, the Lord sent lions among them, which slew some of them. Because it's still, you know, it's still God's country. He had said in Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 12, a land which the Lord thy God careth for, talking to them about the land he was providing. It wouldn't be like Egypt that, you know, they watered manually, but this is one that God cared for. And he said, this is a land which the Lord thy God careth for the eyes of the Lord thy God are always upon it from the beginning of the year, even until the end of the year. There's something different about this piece of real estate. He said, this is my land. In fact, in Zechariah chapter 2, verse 10, speaking of time to come, it says, sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for lo, I come, and I will dwell in the midst of thee, saith the Lord. And many nations shall be joined to the Lord in that day, and shall be my people, and I will dwell in the midst of thee. And thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts has sent me unto thee, and the Lord shall inherit Judah, his portion in the Holy Land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. He's got, that's the city he sent his name on, and he's not done with it, even the whole nation. And so these pagans come in, and the Lord, it seems like, sends lions in there to just start chomping on some of them, to the point where they recognize there's something supernatural. I mean, I know we've just been dumped in this land, and we don't know what this land is like, but there's something about these lions, like, eating us. It just shouldn't be happening. And so it says, wherefore they spake unto the king of Assyria, saying, The nations which thou hast removed and placed in the cities of Samaria know not the manner of the God of this land. Therefore he hath sent lions among them, and behold, they slay them because they know not the manner of the God of the land. Because everybody believed in gods back then, and they believed in very territorial gods, and every piece of property had a god. There was the god of the mountains, and a god of the forest, and a god of the plains, and a god of the sea, and god of this, and god of that. So these people are dumped in this land, and bad stuff starts happening to them. And they say, well, obviously there's a god of this country, and we don't understand his rituals. We don't know what he wants or anything. And these lions, they're gobbling us up. You got to do something. We don't know what we're supposed to do. So in verse 27, it says, then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, carry thither one of the priests whom you brought from thence, and let them go and dwell there, and let him teach them the manner of the God of the land. Isn't this funny? Here you have Israel yanked out of this land. Why? Because they didn't follow the Lord's commandments. They didn't do what he said to do. Now these new people come in and they say, well, there's obviously a problem. We don't understand the God of this land. You better send us one of the priests that used to live here to tell us all about him. Well, the reason why they're gone is because the priests that lived there didn't know anything about him and didn't tell the people. So now you've got somebody who didn't know God and who was a priest, presumably to one of those golden calves, now coming back into Samaria to instruct these pagan people about what they have to do in order to serve the God of Israel. And what we see, it's funny, out of these people, when the lions hit, all of a sudden they realize they have a problem with the God of that land, and so they got to get right with him. They don't know him. But they know they got a problem, and they're scared, so they want to get right. And how many people do you know, when the lion in their life takes a bite out of their backside, oh, funny, I haven't seen you in church for a while. Boom, there you are, first thing in the morning. I remember September 11th happened. I was working down in Old Town, and was it that night or was it the next night? I forget whether it happened on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, but whatever the next Wednesday night was down in Orrington, or it was in Bangor at the time. Wednesday night services were small still. They had them over in, they had the midweek ones still over in the Jewish Community Center, which could only seat a few hundred people. On Sunday mornings when they'd have a big crowd, they'd go over to John Baptist and use the gym. But that Wednesday night, they moved the regular service over to the big gym because it was packed. Normally in children's ministry, we would have, you know, I taught the fifth and sixth graders on Wednesday night back then, and if I had, you know, 10 kids, I was doing well. Well, we had to have it down in the main auditorium that night with the kids because there were so many of them, because all of these people, all of a sudden, something happened to shake their world, and you had all of these foxhole conversions going on. I got to get back to church and find out what's going on again. Couldn't care less about God until that happened, and then all of a sudden, there they are. But it was interesting to watch as things calmed down over the weeks, the numbers went back again to where they were. Because you see a lot of people who have something happen in their life, I need prayer, and they go to church and they get prayer, but it's not genuine. It's just it's a fear, and that's what it is. And they respond to the fear, they respond to the pain, but as soon as the fear has abided a bit, has ceased a little bit, and as soon as the pain has let up, they're gone. And that's what happened to the people of the land. The lions are there. Oh, we need somebody. Send us one of these priests. So they send this guy who doesn't know a whole lot about God anyways to go back there and tell him about God. Verse 28, then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel, right where one of the calves was, and taught them how they should fear the Lord. And you have to ask yourself, what did he teach them? I mean, what could he really teach them? Because what did he know? Because if he knew anything, he wouldn't have been in Bethel, and he wouldn't have been going in front of the golden calf. But here he was trying to tell them about a God that he didn't know himself. And it's, you know, it's kind of like to pass on a disease, you need to be infected yourself. Well, he wasn't infected. He didn't know the Lord. That's why he wasn't there. So he's teaching them how they should fear the Lord. Notice this, verse 29, howbeit every nation made gods of their own and put them in the houses of the high places which the Samaritans had made. And every nation and their cities wherein they dwelt. This was the beginning of Samaria as the New Testament knows Samaria, the Samaritans. You remember in John chapter 4 when Jesus was on the scene, he goes to Samaria, woman at the well, and asks this lady for a drink of water. In John 4:9, it says, "Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, How is it that thou, being a Jew, ask drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." The Samaritans were the half-breeds. They were part Jewish because they'd intermarried with all of these other nations that Assyria dumped in there. And they had a messed up amalgamated worship system. And so the Jews wouldn't have anything to do with them until the point at Jesus' time when they wouldn't even travel through the land. They'd take this long route around Samaria rather than go through it because they felt like the whole ground was infected. There was a mixture there. And the Orthodox Jews, the religious Jews, knew that it was unpleasing to the Lord, that mixture. That has been his message all the way through. From the very beginning with the priestly clothing even, they weren't to make it of mixed types of threads. It had to be one type of thread. That mixture was an abomination of the Lord. You get all the way to the end in Revelation and to the church of Laodicea, Jesus writes and talks to them about being lukewarm, which is the mixture of hot and cold. And when you have that lukewarm, he says, it makes me want to spew you out of my mouth. Because they had sort of something, but it was an amalgamated thing. You remember Jesus talked to that woman at the well, and he said, give me a drink, and then if you knew who I was, you'd ask me to drink. And he says, well, go call your husband. And she says, well, I don't have a husband. And then he tells her, you're right, you've had five, and what you have now isn't a husband. And she says, I think you're a prophet. And then she gets all religious on Jesus in John 4:20, and she says, our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you say, that's the Jews, that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Remember what he said to her? Jesus saith unto her, woman, believe me, the hour cometh where you shall neither in this mountain nor Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you know not what. And that's been the same ever since this passage here in 2 Kings. They worship something, but they didn't know what, because they had lost the knowledge of the Lord, and the guy who came back to tell them didn't know. But Jesus said, we know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeks such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. And they had this kind of mongrel worship thing going on in the north, and it was an abomination to God. And it's, I know if you ever read any of the stuff from, if you ever listen to KP, to Ravi Zacharias, or even read some of KP Yohannan stuff, when you go over and work and try to witness to people in like India, it's a whole different ball game. Because when you tell them about Jesus, they'll receive Jesus gladly and add him to the pile of all the other ones they already have. The idea of an exclusive God doesn't really sit with them because they never thought about that. There's this whole pantheon of gods, and it's the mixture that God finds abominable, mongrel worship. It says, and the men of Babylon made, forgive me, Sukkoth-Benoth, and the men of Kuth made Nergal, and the men of Hamath made Ashima, and the Avites and the Nibhaz and Tartak and the Sepharvites burnt their children in the fire to Adrammelech and Anamelech and the gods of Sepharvaim. This is all the great stuff that's now happening in the land. So they feared the Lord and made unto themselves of the lowest of them priests of the high places, which sacrifice for them in the houses of the high places. We'll just take any old person. In fact, we'll take the bottom rung of the moral food chain, and they're going to be the priests. And they sacrifice in the houses of the high places. They feared the Lord and served their own gods after the manner of the nations whom they carried away from thence. They feared the Lord and served their own gods. How does that work? How can you fear the Lord and serve your own gods? Well, I can tell you what the difference is. They feared the Lord. They felt fear towards the Lord. They felt that way. But they served, that's an action. They served the other gods. They might felt like they understood, or they had reverence to, or they had feelings towards the God of the land, but their worship and their devotion and their actions was after their other gods. Until this day, they do after the former manners. They fear not the Lord, because they say they fear the Lord, but God's testimony is now they don't. They really don't fear the Lord, because they're acting after their other gods. Neither do they after their statutes, or after their ordinances, or after the law and commandments which the Lord commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. And I think that's a little godly sarcasm right there on the part of God. Because Jacob, you remember Jacob, he was the sneaky, conniving manipulator. And then eventually, when he finally wrestled with God and lost, got his hip knocked out of socket, he finally broke. God renamed him Israel. Instead of Jacob, the supplanter that his name meant, he named him Israel, which means governed by God. And here the Lord is saying, he's calling, yeah, he named him Israel, and yet they're not doing after his statutes. They're not acting like they're governed by God at all. With whom the Lord had made a covenant and charged them, saying, you shall not fear other gods, nor bow yourselves to them, nor serve them, nor sacrifice to them. But the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt with great power and a stretched arm, him shall you fear, and him shall you worship, and to him shall you do sacrifice. And the statutes and the ordinances and the law, all of the things he had said, and the commandment which he wrote for you, you shall observe to do forevermore, and you shall not fear other gods. That was their commandment. And the covenant that I have made with you, you shall not forget, neither shall you fear other gods. But the Lord your God you shall fear, and he shall deliver you out of the hand of all your enemies. And what a rebuke, the fact that they were taken away by their enemies, proving God correct. Howbeit they did not hearken, but they did after their former manner. So these nations feared the Lord and served their graven images, both their children and their children's children, as did their fathers. So do they unto this day. Now we come to a great guy. I've been waiting for this guy, because so much of this has seemed like a bummer, because it's just person after person who's been either not serving the Lord at all or completely apart from him, or occasionally you'll find one of those lukewarm guys who, he did this, but not all the way. Finally, we come to a guy. He gets a lot of ink in the Old Testament. I think he's right up there. He's less than David, but I don't know whether he's more than Solomon. I haven't done the math, but I do know he gets a lot of print. He's here in 2 Kings Chronicles. I read a bunch last night about him in Chronicles, and they go into a lot more detail. Isaiah talks about him frequently. There's multiple chapters where Isaiah, because Isaiah was the prophet of the day and was going back and forth with Hezekiah. He's the name that almost should have had his own book. You could make a case for Hezekiah having his own book. It's one of the one you always trick people with. Where's that written? Oh, Hezekiah 3:16. Sounds like it should be, but it's not. The interesting thing about him, his name, Hezekiah, means Jehovah is my strength. He comes from an extremely dysfunctional family. You remember, his dad was Ahaz, the guy who was burning his sons to death in front of false gods. He came from a messed up, screwed up family where dad literally sacrificed his own children on the altar of his own pleasure or his own wants, I guess. Yet he escaped that, he survived that. And look what it says about him. Now it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, that wicked guy, king of Judah, began to reign. 25 years old was he when he began to reign. And he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord. And this is the cool thing. According to all that David his father did. Look at the next thing. He removed the high places, because that was always the thing that nobody else did. They would go part way, they would follow after the Lord, but they'd never get around to cleaning out the high places where the people would worship false gods, you know, on the hilltops and stuff. They never really went all the way. Listen to this. He removed the high places, and he broke the images, and he cut down the groves, and he broke in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and called it Nehushtan. He trusted in the Lord as God of Israel, so that after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor any that were before him. See, what you do is what really defines you. What I do is what defines me. I can say I believe all kinds of stuff. I can intellectually understand certain things, but what it is you do is what it is defines you. So many people want to be defined by what they don't do. Now, do you know the Lord? You witness to somebody who isn't a believer about Christ, and they'll tell you, well, I'm not a drinker, well, occasionally, but I don't do drugs. Well, I never killed anybody. Well, I haven't done this. Well, what you don't do doesn't tell me anything. What you do is what tells me. Well, look what this guy did. Just look at the verbs in verse 4. He removed, he broke, he cut down, he broke. Those were his action verbs. When it came to things that were apart from the Lord, when it came to things in his life that were outside of the will of God, his action was very definite, it was very strong, and it left there was no room for going back. It doesn't say he put away those things, like put them away in the closet until he might need them. It says he busted them, he smashed them, he found those things in the nation that was apart from God's will, and he destroyed them so it wouldn't be a problem anymore. In fact, he went to the point of, I'm sure, offending a lot of people, because he took the brazen serpent that Moses had made, which at this point they were burning incense to, and he called it Nehushtan. He broke it in pieces. You remember the story? It's from Numbers 21. I'll read you a couple verses, verse 4. Israel in the wilderness, wandering because of disobedience, doing what they do best, complaining. It says, and they journeyed from Mount Or by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom, and the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. And the people spoke against God, against Moses, wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loathes this light bread. There's no bread, there's no water, and this bread, we don't like. We just said there was no bread. It's like my kids looking in the fridge. There's nothing to eat except for this food that I don't like. I don't like it. Well, there is something to eat. You just don't like it. They're wandering. It's a hard way. It's a hard journey, and they're complaining against the Lord. And in verse 6, it says, the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much of Israel died. Therefore, the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against thee. Pray unto the Lord that he take away the serpents from us. And Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said unto Moses, make thee a fiery serpent, set it upon a pole, and it shall come to pass that everyone that is bitten, when he looks upon it, shall live. And Moses made a serpent of brass, put it upon a pole. It came to pass, if a serpent had bitten any man, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. And it was, they got bitten, they got poisoned, they were dying from the poison. They cried out, and the Lord says, I want you to take a snake, make it out of brass, stick it on a pole, and then anybody who's been bitten and is dying, just tell them to look at that and they'll be healed. Which doesn't make a whole lot of sense from the natural. I mean, here I am, I'm poisoned, I'm dying, and you're telling me that if I just go out and look at this snake on a pole, I'm going to live? Well, that's what the Lord said to do. And that was how the poison would be eradicated from your system, as if you looked upon the snake on the pole. The snake was causing the problem. The snake on the pole, you look at it, you'll be healed. And it says, as many as looked upon it were healed. The implication is not that everybody looked at it. Because imagine how crazy that would seem. You're sick, you've been bitten, you're dying, and you know your kid finds out about the snake and he runs into your tent and says, Dad, you can. There's a way to be healed. Oh, great, what is it? You got some antidote? You got some antivirus? What, some antivenom? What do you got? And, oh, well, you just go out and look at this snake on a pole. That's stupid. I'm not going to look at any snake on any pole. Well, if you don't look, you don't get healed. Yeah, well, I'm not going to do it. It's stupid. So they die. And we know why that was put up there. Jesus referred to it. John chapter 3, you remember he's talking to Nicodemus. He's trying to explain spiritual things to him. And he says, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And it was really the inspiration for the verses that you all know, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. And in the same way that Christ became sin for us, Paul tells us, when he was on that cross, that serpent in the wilderness was a type of Christ to come. That's why Moses did it as a type to the people, that sin would be judged, it would be held up, and anybody who looked to that would be healed. Type of Christ. Great, that's it. Well, here we are, 800 years later, and they still got that stupid thing, the snake on a pole. And nobody getting bit by snakes anymore. Last we heard there were some lions in the land, but they kept that. And they're burning incense to the snake on the pole. Now, they had been told all the way back in the law, I don't want you to make any graven images to anything. Now, this was something that God had set aside for a particular sign, for a particular type at one instance, but it was gone. The time was past. The snake doesn't need to be on the pole anymore. But here they are, looking to the snake, burning incense to the snake, worshiping the snake. Hezekiah says, enough of that. He calls it Nehushtan, which means a thing of brass. This is a thing of brass. And he smashes it. And he broke it down. You know he ticked a lot of people off when he did that. Because that's been around for 800 years. We've always done that. We've always had the snake, the shiny snake. When I was a kid, I grew up going to the shiny snake and lighting my candle or burning my incense. I got married in front of the shiny snake. I mean, the shiny snake is my thing. And you think, well, that's crazy. Why would they possibly do that? I mean, nobody would do that today. Supposedly, and I looked real hard. I read about it in Milan in Italy. There is a cathedral. It's St. Andrew, St. Ambrose. I forget what it is. Supposedly, one of the religious relics that they have is pieces from this snake that they found and glued back together and built another little snake so you can go burn incense to the Nehushtan again. It's still around. You look at the relics and you think, I mean, that was one of the things in the day that just freaked Martin Luther out about the Catholic Church. And it's still very much a part of it. They believe in religious relics in the Catholic Church. I'm not here just to bash Catholics, but, I mean, I'm just telling you what they do. And it's amazing. They have actually three classes of relics in the Catholic Church. There's the class one, the class two, and the class three. The class one relics, top of the food chain when it comes to religious relics. They believe that all religious relics impart grace. If you make a pilgrimage to go see one of these things, venerate it, which they'll tell you it isn't praying to it. Sort of. Well, it is, but you're not really praying to them. You're just asking them to. It's venerating it. It's not worshiping it. Okay. If you go to one of these things, you get different amounts of grace depending on the importance of the strength of the relic. The first degree, or the first degree relics, the top of the class, if it's actually part of a dead saint, that's a number one. Or if it was one of a piece of one of the things used in the Passion of Christ. Back in the Middle Ages in Martin Luther's day, they were selling splinters from the cross, supposedly, left and right. They were flying out of there. Was it Luther who said, if they put all that together, they'd have enough wood to build a battleship? I mean, in fact, they were questioned about it, and they come up with the miracle of multiplication. The Lord is miraculously multiplying this cross. That's why we keep finding pieces. So that's top tier. If you can go to one of those, pieces of a dead saint. And so you go around, and there's all of these churches. And most every Catholic church at the altar has some relics, like in a box underneath it or whatever, a bone from a finger, some hair from a saint that died. Some of them, and if you want to go look and see, look for Saint Bernadette, go online. They'll have actually, because supposedly there were various saints, men and women, who died, and as a sign of their sainthood, they didn't decompose. And they'll have churches, and in the altar in the front, they'll have a glass coffin with some dead saint in it. And you can go. And, I mean, I just can't imagine getting married in a church with a dead person laying in front of me. I don't understand it. But that's class one. Class two relic, if it was something that was owned by a saint, or if it was an instrument used in the torture or killing of a martyr, that's a class two. Not as good as a class one, but it's still good stuff. If you can make a pilgrimage to go to one of those, that's good stuff. Class three relic, that's bottom rung. And if you just take anything and touch it to a class one or a class two, it becomes a class three. It sort of gets half and those. That's still part of Catholic worship. It's Nehushtan. It's a thing of brass. But, you know, and I just want to bash them because this is Nehushtan stuff in Protestant worship as well. You know, whenever you take somebody and you turn them into a relic of something that happened in the past and you continue to bow down before them, I mean, you look at, Luther. Look at the Lutheran church today. Has said that if Luther came back, he'd take the 99 theses that he wrote for the Catholic Church and nail them to the door of the Lutheran Church. Or the Wesleyans, if Wesley came back, they're ordaining women, they're ordaining homosexuals. Everything that would make those guys spin in their graves, they're doing today. If we take anybody who's a leader, and I wonder what's going to happen in Calvary Chapel when Chuck Smith dies. He's getting up there. He's not going to live forever. You know, if he comes to a place where, and he's a godly guy, I love reading his books and everything, but we don't ever want to put him in the place where we've got a leader that we raise to the level of being an object of veneration or worship. You know, and within the church, people worship education, some branches, eloquence, you know. I mean, we're poised at this point to elect our next president based on the fact that he talks really good. He's a great speech maker. I don't know what you've done for me, but you're a great speech maker. We can take habits or even, you know, type of worship. We have a particular form that we follow. We play some songs and then we teach through the Bible. If anything like that becomes a sacred object that can't be messed with, it's a thing of brass that needs to be smashed and taken down. If it isn't scriptural, if it is apart from God's word, it needs to stop. And I'm sure he ticked a lot of people off when he did it. But I don't think he really cared by the sound of it. Instead, it says he trusted the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor any that were before him. For he clave to the Lord and departed not from following him, but kept his commandments which the Lord commanded Moses. See, those are the other action verbs in verse 5 and 6. He trusted. He clave. The word clave, it's the same one in Genesis. You know, a man shall leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, two shall be one flesh, join that tight. The place I like the best, Job 41:17, uses that same word when the Lord is describing Leviathan to Job, and he talks about his scales that are so tight together that they can't be split apart. They're locked, like the scales on Leviathan, whatever that was. In the same way, that's how Hezekiah was with the Lord, locked on, attached at the hip. He kept his commandments, which the Lord commanded Moses. And notice the result of that. The Lord was with him. And he prospered wherever he went forth. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and served him not. The promise that the Lord always gave all the way through was fear not, fear not, fear not. And then why? Because I'm with you. That's the promise of the Lord. If you keep my commandments, you stick to me, I will be with you. You don't have to fear. That's what he said to Joshua 1:5. There shall not be any man that can stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. I will not fail thee or forsake thee. Jesus, John 14, I will not leave you comfortless. I'll send you another comforter that he shall guide you in all truth. I mean, the Lord with us, that is the promise. If we cleave to him and his commandments, he'll be with us. This guy prospered, just like the guy in Psalm 1. Wherever he went, he prospered. So much so that he rebelled against the king of Assyria and served him not. He smote the Philistines, even unto Gaza, and the borders thereof, from the tower of the watchmen to the fenced city. And it came to pass in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. So he attacks. This is when Assyria comes and attacks Samaria in the north before they overthrew him. And at the end of 3 years, they took it. Even in the sixth year of Hezekiah, that is the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel, Samaria was taken. And the king of Assyria did carry away Israel under Assyria and put them in Halah and in Habor by the river Gozan and in the cities of the Medes, because they obeyed not the voice of the Lord their God, but transgressed his covenant and all that Moses, the servant of God, commanded, and would not hear them nor do them. Who is the voice? They obeyed not the voice of the Lord. We know who the voice is, and he's the one who tells us, if you love me, keep my commandments. Now, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, did Sennacherib, king of Assyria, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah, and he took them. He hits the outlying places. He's taken Samaria in the north, Israel in the north, they're gone. Now he comes up against Judah in the south, and he takes the fenced cities. In fact, one of the things we've uncovered from archaeology is Sennacherib's record of events, where he claims he took 46 cities of the Jews. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria to Lachish, saying, I have offended. Return from me that which thou puttest on me, I will bear. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Apparently, and this was a sign of weakness in Hezekiah. He said, look, I don't want to fight. I'll pay you. Just you put taxes on me. I don't want to fight you. And so he says, the tribute, and this would be yearly, was 300 talents, or about 10 tons of silver, and 30 talents, or about a ton of gold, every year he would have to pay off Assyria to leave him alone and leave him in the land. As we go through this, Assyria is a great type of the flesh. And of course, the flesh wants to be appeased. And Hezekiah makes the mistake of trying to appease the king of Assyria. You can't appease the king of Assyria, just like you and I can't appease the flesh. Proverbs 27:20, the eyes of man are never satisfied. And so he tries to buy him off and see what happens. The same thing that happened in the past when they tried to buy off their enemies. Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found where? In the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house. He ends up robbing himself, and he ends up affecting his worship and his desire to appease the flesh. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the pillars which Hezekiah king of Judah had overlaid and gave it to the king of Syria. But it wasn't enough. It only postponed it. Because now it says the king of Assyria sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish to King Hezekiah with a great host against Jerusalem. And they went up and came to Jerusalem, and when they were come up, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is in the highway of the fuller's field. He sends these three guys. These aren't their names, they're their titles. Tartan was the field marshal, or he was the head general for Assyria. Rabsaris was the chief eunuch, and then Rabshakeh was the kind of like the chief officer or chief of staff that shows up. And they go right outside the city with a big army. When they had called the king, there came out to them Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, which was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder. And Rabshakeh said unto him, speak now unto Hezekiah. Thus saith the great king. That's what Sennacherib had named himself, the great king, the king of Assyria. What confidence is this wherein thou trust? Thou sayest, but they are but vain words, I have counsel and strength for war. Now on whom dost thou trust that thou rebellest against me? Hezekiah decided not to pay that tribute anymore. King of Assyria sends his army and he sends his military leaders. They meet up outside of the city. They've got it surrounded. And he's going to talk a bunch of trash. He's going to try to talk Israel into surrendering. And he's really going to cast a lot of doubt upon everything that Hezekiah and the people are trusting in. And he starts right out by saying, now, on whom do you trust that you rebel against me? And if you take Assyria as a type of the flesh, this is a question that we're all going to have to answer. Because when we fight the flesh fights back. And it doesn't want to be denied. It wants to be in control. It wants to continually take everything you'll give it and more. And when you fight it, the enemy, through our flesh, will ask us, who are you trusting in that you can rebel against me? Now behold, he says in verse 21, thou trustest upon the staff of this bruised reed, even upon Egypt, on which if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, unto all that trust in him. Because Hezekiah was sorely tempted to go back to Egypt to get help. Always want to go back to Egypt for help. In fact, Isaiah spends multiple chapters warning Hezekiah, don't go back to Egypt. Don't do it. The Lord will help you. Don't go back to Egypt. And of course, it was the last thing that happened in the north right before they were taken, is they went and sent to Egypt to try to get help. And now Hezekiah is tempted to do it. And Rabshakeh here tells him, why are you going to lean on him? He's not a staff to lean on. He's so narrow and thin that he'd be like leaning on a spike, and all he'll do is go into your hand if you try to trust in him. And I think for us, you know, the old life, Egypt, we have to be continually reminded, just like Isaiah did for Hezekiah, you can't trust the old life. Don't go back into that. There's no support there. There's no strength there. You cannot lean on that. Don't go. And Rabshakeh figures, well, you're going to go back to that for help against me? That's not going to help. But if you say unto me, we trust in the Lord our God, is not that he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah hath taken away and has said unto Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? The next thing he says is, what? You think you're going to turn to God? You just threw out all of those altars. Because Rabshakeh doesn't know any better, and he thinks that by Hezekiah going through and throwing out all of those other altars and high places and everything, that he had really offended God. And he's saying to him, what, you're going to turn to that God? You've just ticked him off by all of the stuff you've done. He didn't want you to throw out all those altars. He didn't want you to break down the stuff. That was his stuff. And what, you think all those reforms you made are going to save you? He's not going to fight for you now that you've made these reforms. And we hear the same thing. What? Oh, what? Now you pray and you don't go and do that anymore? You don't do this anymore like you used to? Well, you think you can trust in that? God didn't want that. He wasn't against those things. Now, you know, you're just a legalist. You've gone too far. Now God's not going to fight for you. God isn't happy you've made these changes. And it's really a little bit of what he always says, even back to the garden. You know, hath God said? He didn't say that. He didn't want you to tear those down. Now, therefore, I pray thee, give pledges to my lord, the king of Assyria, and I will deliver thee 2,000 horses. Thou be able on thy part to set riders upon them. How then wilt thou turn away the face of one captain of the least of my master's servants and put thy trust on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? He's sitting there with about 200,000 men behind him out in the field. And he says, oh, what, you're going to fight me? I tell you what, I'll make you a deal. Let's make a deal. I'll bring you 2,000 horses if you think you can find even 2,000 people among you that can even ride them. How about that? You're going to fight with me. I will give you, just to make it a fight, I'll give you 2,000 horses if you can find people to ride them against us. And then, how are you going to stand up against the least of our captains or my master's servants and put the trust on Egypt? And you'll notice all of this speech is designed to get them to surrender, because that's what he wants them to do. He doesn't want to fight. He makes it sound like we can kick your tail, we have no problem. If it was really that easy, he would have just done it. But he didn't just do it. He would much rather have them just submit and roll over and open the doors and quit and give up. And so he comes in and he starts talking trash. And he starts talking trash against anything they might turn back to. He starts talking trash against God. He starts making fun of their strength that they do have. He says, am I now come up without the Lord against this place to destroy it? The Lord has said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. Don't you understand? God sent me here. He wants me to defeat you. That's why. I mean, and you just see the twisting this guy is doing, trying to, and he's yelling it loud, we're going to see, because he wants all the people to hear and quit inside the city. Then said Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and Shebna, and Joah, unto Rabshakeh, speak, I pray thee, to thy servants in the Syrian language, for we understand it, and talk not with us in the Jews' language in the ears of the people that are on the wall. Because they're outside of the city, and they're having this little parlay, and these guys that show up who are attacking Israel are speaking in Hebrew to the ambassadors that come out to meet him. And the guys that come out to meet him said, look, would you stop talking in Hebrew? Because all of the soldiers on the wall and all of the people who are out there listening to what we're saying, they're going to hear you. Talk to us in Assyrian, in Aramaic, so that they can't know what's going on. But Rabshakeh said unto them, hath my master sent me to thy master and to thee to speak these words? Hath he not sent me to the men which sit on the wall, that they may eat their own dung and drink their own urine with you? What he's saying is, look, we're going to surround the city. We're going to siege it. It's going to be so bad that everybody inside that city is going to end up eating their own excrement. They're going to be so hungry. That's what happens when we wall up a city so you can't get out. I'm not just talking to you. I'm talking to them so they know what's coming. And so he's yelling that out so that everybody inside will be discouraged. But Rabshakeh said unto them, hath my master sent me to thy master and to thee to speak these words? Oh, I don't want to read that again. Then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language and spake, saying, hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you out of his hand. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us, and this city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Hearken not unto Hezekiah, for thus saith the king of Assyria, make an agreement with me by a present. Start paying tribute again. Give me what I want. Come out to me, and then eat ye every man of his own vine and every one of his own fig tree, and drink ye every one the waters of a cistern. Look, if you just submit and you just give me what I want, you guys can, you don't have to go through a siege. You don't have to get to the place where you're starving that you want to eat your own waste. I'll give you, we'll make sure that everybody has plenty to eat and plenty to drink, and you'll have your own stuff. And I'm going to take you out of the land. He says it in the next verse. We are going to transplant you until I come to take you away to a land, but it's like your own land, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of all oil, olive, and of honey, that you may live and not die. And hearken not unto Hezekiah when he persuades you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. See, this land that God has given you, that you don't want that. We've got a good land for you. Yeah, we're going to take you out of here, but it's a good land. It's just like this one. What I have to offer is just as good. And you don't have to go through the pain of a war. You don't have to have a fight. It's the same thing that Satan said to Christ when he took him up in the wilderness. You don't have to go to the cross. I'll give you all of this stuff. Just worship me. And I'll give you everything you want. And it's the same stupid lie we get. Oh, the enemy has great stuff for us back in the world. It's just like what God has, except for you don't have to go through the fight. And then he says, hath any of the gods of the nations delivered at all this land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and of Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hena, and Eva? Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? The sad thing is, all of those gods that he mentions were gods that they were serving in the north. And he said, what good did those gods do in the north? Are they going to do you any, what good is your God going to do? But check this out. The people held their peace, and they answered him not a word. For the king's commandment was saying, answer him not. It's a conversation you don't even want to entertain. You don't want to argue with him. You don't want to dialogue. You don't want to try to reason with him. There's no reasoning with the flesh. All you can do is crucify the flesh. Die, die, die. Put it to death. The way you make it shut up is you starve it. Then came Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, which was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and Joash the son of Asaph, the recorder, to Hezekiah with their clothes rent, and told him the words of Rabshakeh. And they're humbled, and they're upset, and they go to Hezekiah, and we're going to see in the next chapter, he does the right thing. You know, he's going to go, a letter's going to be sent with the same stuff in it, and he's going to take that in front of the Lord and say, God, did you hear what they're saying about you? What are you going to do about this? They're saying that you can't defend us, that you're just like all the other gods. Lord, please fight for us. And it comes to that really cool story where in one night, one angel comes into Sennacherib's camp of 185,000 and decimates, and he wakes up in the morning and says they're all corpses. The Lord does fight for him because he's now gone from offending Hezekiah to offending the Lord in a fight. But I really like what Hezekiah told him. Don't answer. Don't entertain it. Don't get into that conversation. Just let him run his mouth. We'll let the Lord do our answering for us. Come on, Bobby, let's pray and we'll get out of here with a song. Lord, thank you so much, God, that you are, Father, willing to fight for us. Help us not to be deceived. Lord, help us not to give in to those things that sound attractive or even have a form of godliness. But Lord, let us be like Hezekiah, men who, women who break, tear down, make no provision for anything.